Radio Indiana, WIBC, Indianapolis.
July 30th, 1945. The USS Indianapolis became a casualty of war in 12 minutes. What happened after she was hit by torpedoes fired by a Japanese sub resulted in the largest single loss of life at sea from one ship in the history of the United States Navy. But the men who survived and lived to tell their story in the 75 years since were subjected to 4 days of horror.
Some people were hurt so badly they couldn't take care of themselves, and other guys were holding them up.
Tall boys jump off, jump over.
Treading water in the salty sludge of oil and muck on the top of the Philippine Sea, they watched and waited for a rescue, knowing only a miracle could bring a plane close enough to find them.
And then all of a sudden you hear a blood-curdling scream and you see that capot go under.
And you feel something go by your leg or it shakes you a little bit over the shark.
And many believe a miracle is just what happened.
I thought God was with us from the moment that I got into the water, believe it or not.
USS Indianapolis steams into harbor with President Franklin Roosevelt aboard.
The first atomic bomb exploded.
You'll now hear the stories of men who say they are not heroes.
And I can see all that oil on the water, and I'm holding on to that cable, pouring my heart out to the Lord, thinking this is the end of life.
I was lucky enough to be rescued, and I mean, that was it.
The stories of men who pledged their lives to defend their country, many of whom paid that price.
He was, in fact, the only man in the history of the Navy to be court-martialed for having his ship sunk out from under him as an act of war.
Men who found out what it's like to live while watching their friends, buddies, superiors, shipmates, fellow sailors and Marines make their final journey to the bottom of the ocean.
It's a very emotional experience. I think that the thing that I was feeling more than anything else was a tremendous feeling of gratitude.
You'll hear of the temptation to give up and the courage to stay alive.
I said, get rid of your knives and your sidearms because somebody will battle you for them and somebody will get killed.
You'll hear USS Indianapolis, despair and deliverance.
There are 1,280 remarkable stories, and probably some of the most remarkable stories are the ones we don't know, because they died with the sailor who went down with the ship.
Freedom as we know it in this country has always come with risks. Each July in Indianapolis, that freedom is celebrated.
Bernard Bateman, James A. Bean, James B. Belcher.
Along with the 1,195 men who were aboard the USS Indianapolis when she was hit and sunk.
Great is thy faithfulness, O God, my Father.
The ceremonies are a mix of secular and religious because many of the survivors give credit to God for making it through one of the worst scenarios imaginable for any ship and crew in the Navy. The story of the ship begins with her construction in 1930 and commissioning in 1931 as a Portland-class flagship, meaning she could carry and host flag officers. The Indianapolis also frequently carried President Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
It's 1936 as USS Indianapolis steams into harbor of Rio de Janeiro with President Franklin Roosevelt aboard. And cheers greet him as he's welcomed to South America's biggest republic by President Getulio Vargas.
On December 7th, 1941, the Indianapolis was not at Pearl Harbor.
Japan, like its infamous Axis partners, struck first and declared war afterwards.
She was at the isolated Johnston Atoll.
Navy was the loss of war vessels, airplanes, and equipment.
But when the attack happened, the Indianapolis was ordered to join the fleet in searching for the Japanese carriers responsible for the attack in Hawaii. They were not located. During the first 4 years of the war, the ship was part of missions and operations in New Guinea and the Aleutian Islands, where she battled Japanese planes and ships successfully.
It was just like a movie, but, you know, it wasn't a movie. This was real stuff.
Harlan Twible, who died in 2018, was on board the Indianapolis on her last mission. It was his first assignment out of the U.S. Naval Academy.
Lieutenant General Buckner and Vice Admiral Turner observed the 5th Fleet's terrific bombardment of Okinawa.
At Okinawa, the Indianapolis inflicted damage upon Japanese planes.
In one afternoon, 111 enemy planes are shot down.
And damage was inflicted upon her when a suicide plane's pilot bombed the ship, crashing his aircraft.
The Japs try everything, including suicide planes, and a few of them succeed in damaging ships.
The bomb exploded in the keel of the ship, flooding some compartments, killing 9 men. The flooding was stopped by the bulkheads, but the bomb did enough damage to send the ship to San Francisco for repair. That put her in the right place at the right time for a secret mission, carrying uranium and parts for the atomic bomb known as Little Boy to Tinian Island. That bomb would be dropped on Hiroshima just days later. Indianapolis left San Francisco on July 16, 1945, and made Pearl Harbor in record time, then on to Tinian Island. Once she left Tinian, the Indianapolis stopped at Guam to replace some crewmen, then headed on to the Philippine Sea for training.
So I was on watch, and I was getting off the out of the tub that I was in, sky aft.
July 30th, just after midnight.
And the torpedo hit and almost threw me to the deck.
Harlan Twible, in this interview from 2001, recalls the moment of the impact of the torpedoes from a Japanese submarine and what happened immediately after.
I proceeded down to the deck and went up to see the exec at midships and asked him what I should do. That's what I was supposed to do at that time. He said, go amidships and take the men to the high side. And at that point, we were only about a foot out of the water on the starboard side. The ship had gone over.
I'd gotten off a watch at 12 o'clock, and I made my pilot under the barrels of what we call number one turret. The first torpedo hit along about here, and it actually cut the whole bow off.
Ed Harrell in an interview for Bethany House Ministries.
I'm within 25 feet of where the bow was cut off, and the second torpedo behind me, so to speak, I'm in between the two, saw boys jump off, jump over, and I could see all that oil on the water, and I'm holding on to that cable, pouring my heart out to the Lord, thinking this is the end of life.
Coming up, as the ship listed and sailors and Marines went into the water, the stories of what kept some of the men alive.
One of the first things that I had to do was to make sure that these people did all that they could to help themselves.
And how others met death in the loneliness of the expanse of the Pacific Ocean. You're listening to USS Indianapolis, Despair and Deliverance.
Tahupa, that's the USS Indianapolis.
You on the Indianapolis?
What happened? Japanese submarine slammed 2 torpedoes into our side, Chief. He was coming back from the island of Tinian to Lady and just delivered the bomb, the Hiroshima bomb. 1,100 men went into the water. The vessel went down in 12 minutes.
Actually, the way I first heard about this story is pretty much the way I think everybody else in America today heard about it from the movie Jaws when I was a plebe at the Naval Academy.
Yeah.
You're listening to USS Indianapolis, Despair and Deliverance.
We knew that there was this movie out there that had played for months and months and months, and we wondered what could be so fascinating about this movie that it would continue on for so long.
Captain William Toty was the last commander of the submarine USS Indianapolis, decommissioned in 1998. He's an advocate for the crew of the World War II ship.
Didn't see the first shark for about half an hour. Tiger, 13-footer, you know that when you're in the water, Chief? You tell by looking from the dorsal to the tail.
Finally, we got to see it, heard the story, Robert Shaw's wonderful description of the tragedy, and we were embarrassed to find out that we didn't know whether this was a true story or not.
Well, we didn't know. Because our bomb mission had been so secret, no distress signal had been sent. They didn't even list as overdue for a week. Very first light, Chief. Sharks come cruising.
Oh, I was sleeping topside when it happened.
Oh, well, then you were rudely awakened, weren't you?
Yes.
Survivor Dick Thielen.
I laid down at 10 minutes to 12 because I had the 4-8 watch on the bow in Twin 20s up there. The man was supposed to be waking me up about 3:45. I laid down at 10 minutes to 12. The ship blew up at 12:10. so I didn't lay there very long.
The people who were coming up from below decks were burned and wounded.
When the Indianapolis was hit by two torpedoes, the ship immediately listed. Harlan Twible, a new officer, was told by the ship's executive officer to get the men up to the high side.
People don't understand the fact that when a ship blows up, shrapnel is all over the place. If you don't get hit, you're a lucky person.
Twible was not spared from shrapnel. He took a piece in the side, but his duty was to help everyone he could.
This thing was going to go over. And I said, over the side, and nobody moved. And I said, follow me, and then they all followed me, and we started 4 days and five nights and a horrible experience.
Peace I give unto you, not as the world giveth, give I unto you. Let not your hearts be troubled. Don't be afraid. I learned those things in Sunday school, and seemingly the Lord was revealing those to me, and I thought, thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord.
Ed Harrell, in an interview with Bethany House Ministries, says he had been holding on to a cable caught between two gaping chasms where the torpedoes had hit.
And I climbed over the rail and went into the water, jumped in feet first.
Well, the next thing that I did was I yelled, swim away, because I knew that this ship would create a suction and bring everybody down with it. And very fortunate. People did what I asked them to do, and we swam away. And I'd gotten out about 100 yards, and I looked back, and there was a ship going down by the bow.
And I get out to my first buddies out there, and then after a period of time, daylight comes. Well, of course, we had company the first morning. We had sharks.
Dick Thielen remembers going into the water with nothing on but his underwear, which he wrapped around his head by day to protect him from the sun.
And the shark voice is poking me in my life jacket. That was his eyes and my eyes about that far apart.
Realizing what the dangers were, Harlan Twible had the task of trying to preserve every life he could. But around 300 people had gone down with the ship.
Well, the first thing we had to do was to get a little bit organized, and one of the men in my group was Gunnar Horner, the oldest man on the ship, 49 years of age, the chief warrant gunner. I gave an order, and nobody obeyed, and Gunnar Horner piped up, and of course everybody knew who Gunnar Horner was, and they respected me, said, you heard the officer, do what he says. And they did what I told them to do, and we started to tie ourselves to the nets.
Twible says the men organized in groups. 800 people were left after the ship sank.
One of the first things that I had to do was to make sure that these people did all that they could to help themselves. And
you've heard about the dangers from sharks that the men encountered on their first morning after the Indianapolis sank. But when you're stuck in the water, other dangers and temptations can and did end with death. The food and water went down with the ship.
I passed the order out that anybody had swallowed any salt water, they should vomit. And I explained to them if they didn't, their tongues would swell up and they would choke themselves to death. Some of the guys had booze that sneaked onto the ship, and they had that with them. And I told them, I said, this will dehydrate you and you'll die. And other guys still had their sidearms because we were on watch, and I said, get rid of your knives and your sidearms, because somebody will battle you for them and somebody will get killed. And they did it. There was no way that I could enforce it. They just did it because I asked them to do it.
Harlan Twible and others had organized in groups, tied off to each other, tiny specks upon the surface of the ocean.
The first morning, maybe someone that had been injured and he has a temperature now and he begins to hallucinate. And all of a sudden, he thinks that he sees an oasis over there.
Ed Harrell recalls that the men who didn't stay together were most often the victims of hungry sharks, whose fins parted the surface of the water as they sensed flesh, now vulnerable, as the legs and bodies of the men resembled the shark's prey.
And here he gets out of the group, and here he's going to whatever he thinks he sees. And then all of a sudden you hear a blood-curdling scream and you see that capot go under. And then like a fish cork, you know, it brings that body back to the surface. But then you see many, many fins of the sharks around that blood. And of course you dare not go to try to find out who your buddy might have been because of the danger.
I never got hit. Some people got hit. We lost a lot of people. But the people we lost were stragglers. And, you know, there gets to be a point where you can't control people, and they would cut themselves loose from the nets, and they would swim away. And those were the ones, they were the ones that would be taken down, and the sharks would eat their extremities, and the bodies would pop up. And, of course, that made everybody frightened to death. And I don't want you to think that any of us were heroes on this thing. We were all scared. We were just as scared as you could be, but by the grace of God, some people were able to help.
Zweibel said he's a man of faith, and faith is part of what helped him get through those 4 days.
I thought God was with us from the moment that I got into the water, believe it or not, and I never thought I would die. And I think that was a blessing, because I expended every ounce of my energy in helping others. Well, they thought somebody was in charge, but, you know, you look back now, and I just sort of chuckled just a second ago. I wasn't in charge of anything, you know, really. I didn't know whether a distress signal had gotten off. I didn't know whether anybody was going to get us. And in the next 4 days was one of encouragement. You know, we'll make it, fellas.
You made it that far.
Yeah.
The next 4 days were spent in extreme heat during the day and cold during the night, floating with life jackets, treading water, and having little to cling to save prayer.
It was the second day that my buddy Spooner wanted to give up, gone into the water head first.
The salt water was unfit to drink, but the surface of the water was also covered in a sludge of oil that bubbled up from the ship and covered some of the crewmen, with no way to get it off.
He had all that oil in his eyes, and now, you know, how do you get that out? You don't. I turned his back to mine and fastened his capok to mine, and we swam together through that rest of that second day.
The temptation to drink the water was too much for some men, says Ed Harrell. Some of his shipmates couldn't stand it anymore and drank and got dehydrated and died. You've heard some of the stories that the men could see planes flying over at night. Harlan Zweibel didn't recall it that way.
We're looking back now from 56 years later.
Yeah.
My group never saw a plane.
What he did recall in 2001 was the loneliness that permeated the group of men who were left, who had not died from dehydration, shark attack, exposure, drowning, or salt poisoning. And the men who endured, who prayed into the night sky, had thoughts of home and family, but little else to hold on to. Coming up, the reason to hold on.
I was on a ship that sank, so I swam around there for 5 days.
You're listening to USS Indianapolis, Despair and Deliverance. No one was looking for the USS Indianapolis. Lieutenant Stuart Gibson was the officer who had been tracking her movements. He knew she had not arrived at her destination, and he had not reported it. The men who were left after the ship sank waited for 4 days and 5 nights in the water, dehydrated, hungry, cold by night and hot by day, many not knowing if a distress signal had been sent out before the Indianapolis sank after being hit by 2 Japanese torpedoes.
Seen a shooting star tonight.
You're listening to USS Indianapolis, Despair and Deliverance.
My group never saw a plane. We did see some shooting stars. And, of course, people yelled it was a very pistol, and it wasn't a very pistol. It was a shooting star.
Seen a shooting star tonight. Slip away.
110-degree weather, and you're swimming, and you're struggling. And you're desperate for water. You see a little rain cloud coming. Well, how much water can you catch in your big mouth out in a little rain shower? You take those greasy hands and you kind of cup that water and you get some fresh water, maybe just a few tablespoons full, but that's all the water that I had for 4.5 days.
No, we didn't see anything until Chuck Gwynn came in, and I got to tell you, that's an emotional story in itself, because Chuck came in, and they were fixing an antenna on the plane, he told me later, and they looked down, they saw the oil slick, and Chuck thought, geez, I'm gonna get myself a Japanese submarine.
The story of the rescue of the crew of the USS Indianapolis, as told by Harlan Twible in 2001. He passed away in 2018.
He went out and he's coming in for a bombing run, and somebody said, "Those are people down there." So Chuck pulled up and wiggled his wings and made a couple of passes to let us know he'd seen us. And he called back to the base, and the base sent out some Catalinas, and a B-17 came over us and dropped a lifeboat. And for the next 18 hours, we did nothing but try to keep people alive and not do the crazy thing that would kill them. They've gone this far. We wanted to stay alive.
And there we are, all the men waving to them, yelling, waving.
As remembered by Victor Buchan, the story told in 2014 at a Navy event.
And he don't know who we are, whether we're friend or foe. But he says, "Oh, my God, there's a ton of men down there." Then he radios back to his station. And his station sends out another plane, Adrian Marks. And Adrian Marks comes, and he's not supposed to land his plane. And he said, "I'm going to land this plane because too many people are being eaten by sharks." He landed his plane, and by God, he saved 57 men. The plane couldn't take off because it was all full of holes, but he did save those men.
I will send out an army to find you in the middle of the darkest night. It's true, I will rescue you.
The next step was to radio the ships that were nearby to get them going as fast as possible.
There was a light. Searchlight that from one of the destroyers, and it was the Doyle who sent the light up into the air so that we knew that these ships were on their way.
Yeah, the ships would pick me up, the USS Doyle picked up 96 survivors.
Dick Thielen.
One guy on the way to the hospital, the five got in, so they got there.
What kind of shape were you in that day when they picked you up, Dick?
Real bad. I was next to that too. There was a spot I don't remember going off the door into the hospital in Palalu. I don't remember that.
Well, you proved you're one tough son of a gun, didn't you? You're still here.
Well, everybody says, you know, you can't live without food and water that long, but we did.
Burned, thirsty, poisoned from salt water, and from ingesting diesel oil from the giant wave that doused the crew when the mighty vessel dove bow first into the water, 316 men made it away from the USS Indianapolis, leaving behind their ship and friends in one of the Earth's deepest oceans. The survivors were able to tell the story of the Indianapolis, but many wouldn't until decades later. Some would have to. They would be duty-bound to testify before Congress and at the court-martial of the ship's commander, Captain Charles McVeigh, III.
Of over 300 ships that were sunk during World War II that had captains, he was, in fact, the only man in the history of the Navy to be sunk, to be court-martialed for having his ship sunk out from under him as an act of war.
Testifying on charges that the captain failed his crew by not ordering them to abandon ship and that he didn't follow Navy orders to zigzag to avoid a torpedo attack was the commander of the Japanese sub that fired on and sunk Indianapolis.
And that was a very, very controversial event, even during the day.
William Toty, the last captain of the submarine Indianapolis, who made it his mission to clear Captain McVeigh's name.
In fact, the major newspapers of the time were decrying the fact that the Navy was bringing the enemy in to testify against an American hero. And remember that McVeigh was a man who had won the Silver Star for gallantry in action in another campaign. In fact, he'd won the Bronze Star for his action in the Battle of Okinawa.
McVeigh's defense was partly that the Navy had not warned that a Japanese submarine was in the area and that they did not provide an escort for the ship. Though he had been in seven battles just in his time as commander of the Indianapolis and over the objections of Admiral Chester Nimitz, McVeigh was made to endure the court-martial that included testimony from the enemy commander, Makitsura Hashimoto.
What he said was it would have changed the tactics slightly, but not the outcome. And that backfired on the prosecution. Of course, the prosecution brought him in to say, hey, he wasn't zigzagging, and if he had been, it would have been much tougher for me to shoot him. In fact, American submarine commanders sunk over 5,000 ships during the war. Most of those ships were zigzagging. We train even today to shoot against ships that were zigzagging. So zigzagging is a futile, but really the only thing that a warship has at its disposal to complicate the submarine's fire control solution.
So Captain McVeigh was found guilty of failure to follow a zigzag pattern and hazarding his ship.
Hunter Scott was in the sixth grade when he learned of the Indianapolis's sinking while watching Jaws with his dad. That was in 1998. He decided to make the sinking a history project and began tracking down and interviewing the men who were still alive, eventually collecting over 100 documents and interviewing 150 people. He not only won prizes in his home state of Florida, but determined that Captain McVeigh was not at fault. Though McVeigh was allowed to return to the service and retired as a rear admiral in 1949, the years after the sinking were especially tough.
Every year since the court-martial, Captain McVeigh would be getting hate mail from many people who lost their loved ones aboard the Indianapolis. For instance, at Christmas time, he would get a letter from a family member saying, I hope you're having a happy Christmas because I'm not. You killed my son, you blankety blank.
Scott says none of the survivors whom he interviewed felt that way about the captain.
The letters and the fact that Captain McVeigh's father and grandfather before him had both been high-ranking officials in the Navy, so it was expected that Captain McVeigh was one day to become the chief of naval operations. So Captain McVeigh had really felt that he had let down his family name. So he committed suicide in 1968.
You know, we do know that this bore heavily upon him, and he said that many times he's quoted as saying, I died when my ship went down. I should have gone down with it.
Both Captain Toti and Hunter Scott worked with survivors to try and clear Captain McVeigh's name. While Toti studied the case and was convinced that the conviction was correct, even if it wasn't justified, Scott took his project to his congressman, Joe Scarborough, who then took the research to D.C.
The survivors and I, we completely embarrassed the Navy. I didn't really make them too happy.
He eventually testified in front of Congress with information on whether the Navy may have actually been at fault for the loss of life when the ship sent out distress signals.
One of them was received, and it was thought of to be a prank call by the Japanese to lure rescue vessels in the area.
You're hearing Scott speak at age 16 in 2002.
In another place, the guy who received it reported it to his boss, who was drunk at the time, and so they did nothing about it there.
It took some doing, but Scott's persistence paid off in the year 2000.
The Congress passed a resolution that they included in the Defense Appropriation Act, which said that the American people should consider the Captain McVeigh exonerated for any culpability in the sinking of his ship.
Captain McVeigh had essentially been cleared, but his legacy was not the only piece of USS Indianapolis history with unfinished business.
The important thing is that some of us did live.
Coming up,
I'll come here looking for a ship.
A journey to the bottom of the ocean.
It's a business operation.
You're listening to USS Indianapolis, Despair and Deliverance.
3, 2, 1, launch!
A new USS Indianapolis. You're listening to USS Indianapolis, Despair and Deliverance.
The USS Indianapolis lives again. This Saturday morning in Groton, Connecticut, the commissioning ceremonies for the USS Indianapolis SSN 697 were completed.
Launched in 1977 and commissioned in 1980, the third Indianapolis was a nuclear attack sub.
I'm aboard the Merchants Bank Learjet coming back from Groton, Connecticut to Indianapolis. On board with Indianapolis Mayor Bill Hudnut.
Very emotional experience. I think that the thing that I was feeling more than anything else was a tremendous feeling of gratitude for this accomplishment, for the survivors and those who gave their lives 32 years ago today on the USS Indianapolis that went down in the Pacific Ocean close to the end of World War II. There were many of the survivors there, and I couldn't help but think back to 32 years ago and what the sacrifice that those men and boys made for our country means to us today in terms of keeping our country strong and free.
From the Merchants Bank Learjet at 41,000 feet headed back for Indianapolis, this is Fred Heckman, WIBC News.
The fourth ship to bear the name, USS Indianapolis, kept the tradition going. Commissioned October 26, 2019.
This ship embraces innovation and technology. It will be the skill and bravery of her crew that brings her to life.
As with the submarine, survivors of the World War II Indianapolis sinking made it to see the new ship. Besides building a new USS Indianapolis, the legacy of the World War II cruiser has largely been, until 2017, the mystery of its location.
Welcome to Paul Allen's Research and Exploration Vessel Petrel. I'm Rob Kraft. This is Paul Mayer and our pilot Scott Matthews. And we are live above the USS Indianapolis in an undisclosed location in the Philippine Sea. She is 18,000 feet below us. So let's go to ROV video.
When the Indianapolis was found with detailed sonar and an underwater drone in 2017, billionaire Paul Allen sent a crew with cameras to one of the world's deepest shipwrecks.
Indianapolis came to rest down here after traveling 3.5 miles through the water column. When it landed and made a huge crater.
The cameras brought back pictures that showed the ship is well preserved, pictures that show great detail, down to the Japanese battle flags painted in succession on the wall of the bridge to signify each victory.
From where it is now to where the bow is, that's just over a mile.
But long before the ship was located, there was a feeling from some of her crew that such a trip was not necessary.
My attitude is to let these people that are in the hull rest in peace.
Harlan Twybel.
I just don't think that we need to know. You know, everybody has his own thoughts on this thing. Some people want to know whether how bad the ship was damaged. I know how bad it was damaged. It went under.
Mm-hmm.
And it went down in 12 minutes, which is unbelievable almost. But I don't want to know that the bow was blown off, which would mean that, you know, my friends were killed and instantly or not instantly. None of this stuff is of importance to us today. The important thing is that some of us did live.
I'm surprised they even looked for it, really.
Dick Thielen, upon hearing the news that the ship had been found.
I've been talking to different groups, church, and a lot of different people. And through the years, they asked me, how come they're looking for the ship? I said, well, they put it on television, and they sell commercials. In other words, it's a business operation. But I also tell them it's a big joke. I lost my billfold.
USS Indianapolis submarine captain William Toady on the TV special with a different perspective.
After all these years, they're finally going to be able to put a pin on a map and say, this is where my loved ones lie. And for the survivors, being able to look at this ship, remarkably, after 72 years, really does close a chapter for them.
Is it appropriate to take anything from this wreck?
It's not. It turns out we have a builder's bell from the ship, so there'd be no reason to disturb this wreck, and it shouldn't be done.
For now, the resting place of over 800 people will remain as is, 18,000 feet below the surface of the water. Whether it was because of humility, not believing they were and are heroes, or perhaps the trauma of watching their brethren disappear below the water, many of the survivors did not speak of what had happened to them for years after.
I never ever let anybody even interview me until 1989. And the reason for it was I didn't want this to be my life story. I had other things to do, and I had a very rewarding life afterwards.
When the movie Jaws came out, and they hired me up and put my picture in the paper and all that. A lot of people didn't even know I was on that ship.
Dick Thielen didn't even tell those people closest to him about his being a member of the crew.
Years ago, I didn't talk about it because I was married in 1951. In 58, the abandoned ship book came out. Of course, we got it and read it. I didn't say one word in 7 years to my wife about it. And when she found out, she was one mad woman. Now, I just heard it. I didn't tell anybody.
That's a common thread. Why didn't you fellas ever talk about your experiences?
Well, I couldn't because it brings back memories. A lot of people are the same way. And the only thing that helped us, we formed this reunion in 1960. That way we got together, we kind of compared stories and made friends that we didn't have.
Fred Freaks, Nicholas Fedorsky, Donald J. Phelps, Albert E. Ferguson.
At the Indianapolis reunion in 2016, held in the city for which the ship was named, Captain William Toady spoke the words of Captain Charles McVeigh when he spoke at the very first reunion in 1960.
Shipmates, let us assume that the Indianapolis could speak for herself, and permit me, if you will, to project what she might say. First, and please remember I'm speaking for your ship, she would say, thank you for turning out in so great a number tonight. I want to tell your wives and your families how proud I am of you. By your presence here tonight, you're telling me and our shipmates who are not with us that what you stood for in war still means much to you in peace. You still believe that freedom is worth fighting for.
And the reunion turned out to be a kind of recovery from the whole thing.
The legacy of the ship and crew is perhaps now in the hands of the people who want to tell the story beyond survivor accounts, perhaps because of the many fascinating aspects of the story. A movie starring Nicolas Cage was released in 2016.
President Truman has chosen you to lead a highly classified mission.
Yes, sir!
A play was produced based on the plight of Captain McVeigh.
The play is set in water. A lot of people at the end of the show, I will say, don't know what to say. But to find out things that happened in Captain McVeigh's life and those sailors out there on the seas in the Pacific.
That's director Brian Froots.
But if someone were to try and put the story in perspective with the history of the war and the world since, the words of the men who survived would probably best serve that task.
We prayed, everybody prayed, in the whole group we prayed as a group, and I think that had a lot of us. I think that's one of the things that got me through it.
So many people, even my family, so many people. I go talk someplace, they clap, I'm a hero.
Dick Thielen doesn't believe he was a hero.
I tell them I was on a ship that sank. So I swam around there for 5 days. I was lucky enough to be rescued. And I mean, that was it. And I said, a lot of guys spend, say, a year or two in a foxhole. You know what I'm saying? Or a prison camp.
Admiral Sam Cox and Captain William Toady are both men who have stepped back and look at the story from a broader view.
I would prefer people to focus on the heroism and the valor of the crew, which actually began long before the ship was torpedoed and sunk.
These were remarkable Americans who performed bravely, extraordinarily.
Original interviews by Stan Lear, Terry Stacey, and Bethany House. USS Indianapolis, Despair and Deliverance.